Accession number 22355, Mr. Vajce, Leo 1.
Fred Wiltshire, Leo 1, where were you born, please?
Oh, you want me to put, sorry.
Yes.
Yes. Where was I born?
Yeah.
In a place called Queen's Corner.
Where's that?
Denham, where it used to come under Iping, Milan. It's under, it comes under Milan. It used to come out Iping Midhurst, see? In the area of Midhurst.
Which year was this?
Pardon?
Which year was this?
1923.
Whereabouts did you grow up and go to school?
A place called Hollycombe School in Milan. There's a Church of England school, and I started when I was 5 years old. We used to walk to school, you know, about three and a half miles, across the fields, and then the lanes and then the roads.
How old were you when you finished there?
14.
So, you left school before the war?
Yes, before the war, yes.
Did you get a job?
Yeah, I got a job in an engineering firm in Midhurst, but T.H. Russell's Limited.
Is that what you were doing when war broke out?
No, I'd left it. I got the sack from there made redundant, I suppose, because there was no trade coming. And I mean, all the petrol pumps had all closed down, so they just told me to look for another job. And I went and looked for another job, and I went on building tank runways then for the Canadian tanks up at Headley Down. Headed down up near Greyshot, and we had to make these tank runways, you know, angled off the road for all the Sherman tanks to park in, you know. And
was this concreting work?
All concreting work, yes. Yeah, we just took the job on, about four of us was, all friends, you know, all locals, the boys we were. We just took this on as we took the first job, we come along, we took work, so, and that was it. We had to take a job. Because otherwise, if you went to the Labour Exchange and they just give you a green card, and that you had an option of three jobs on that card, three different places they told you to go, and if you never get a job, you wouldn't get no money, dole money at all, they wouldn't they? So, you know, we went around three different sites, like, you know, and what was the best to us, we just took and we all worked as a gang, four of us. And we'd done all these concrete runways up at Headley there.
Were you doing that very long?
Oh, for about 9 months, I suppose, were you?
In the early part of the war?
In the early part of the war, yes, yeah.
Was there any bombing there by the German Air Force?
No, not at the moment there. They used to come over every night, whatever, like you could hear them coming over, and we could sit from where my mother lived, you could watch the bombs going in up in London, the sky used to light up. And they dropped odds and ends of bombs around, like, you know, when there was. Just got rid of them, I suppose. They didn't want to go into London, they just got rid of them and ran the area. There's one dropped, I suppose, about half a mile from home. An exploded bomb went down in this clay. The RAF come and dug a big trench down and got it out. Never got it out, they blew it up. Never done no damage to the ace foot, and all those ace only about 100 yards away from them. Never tucked in all the buildings, they never exploded. The whole explosion went straight up and never touched the ace, or never done a thing to the ace.
Where did this bomb land?
At Iping, by Iping Marsh Church, about 100 yards from the churchyard, beyond the farm building.
Is Iping in Surrey or in Hampshire?
Sussex.
What happened to you next?
Oh, from there, when I became 18, I went from home, I went to Brighton for a medical. Got on the train up at Liphook, went down to Havant and changed, went to Brighton, had a medical, and then I went in, had the medical, and we'd done a small exam on different books, you know, different shapes and sizes of different things. We had to tell them what fitted in, number what fitted into each different shape to make the what name up. And that was on, before the end of October. In November, I have a call-up papers beginning of November, called up. 1942, that was. And I went to Chester to a machine gun depot, the Cheshire Machine Gun Depot. And I'd done 7 weeks there training. And then I went 2 weeks then to the MT wing on a driver instructions course, which I didn't need because I'd already been driving vehicles obeyed. And I just went down there and, the bloke, the sergeant took us out on his lorries. We went all up through Wells into, we just go up around these hills with these vehicles and then come back, and he said to me, you better jump in and have a drive. And I went down about the 100 yards, he said, the best thing you get in the back, sit in the back. He said, you don't need no instruction. So that's what I've done for a fortnight, 3 weeks.
How had you got on with military training?
Very well, yes. Yeah, we went, square, on the square, and learned about machine guns and bombs and chucked hand grenades and went, on the rifle ranges, firing rifles and all that.
What kind of machine guns were there?
A Vickers 303 and the Bren gun. And then we went on a day's course on the hand grenade, the Mills hand grenade, and then the NGA, we went to a bunker and we threw them at the bunker to a safe so we was in a safe area
What advice did they give you about throwing a grenade?
Oh, well, they explained to you that you had to hold the grenade there, and there was a split pin there which held the lever down, and once you pulled the pin out and you laid yourself back and lobbed it over as far as you could, and of course the split pin released the lever, and there was, I think it was about 8 second and a 10 second fuse, I think, and between your drops, different fuses, and we just done practice about 3 or 4 of these hand grenades, and that was it. We never done them all, and they're just a, but they told you the ins and outs of how to prime the grenades and all this, what you had to do.
How do you prime them?
We unscrewed the bottom and had a little round tin, there was, with about 4 fuses in there. It's like a U shape. And one was smaller, one was lower, and you just pushed them up in there and you screwed the cap up tight. Make sure the split pin was in, so the lever didn't come off. Because once the lever was gone, you see this pin just come down and strike the fuse and set the 10 seconds or 8 seconds, whatever the fuse were, to explode it.
Did you have any comrades who were too clumsy to use them properly?
There was one chap there, did he drop one in the trench, and because we weren't in the trench, you only went in the trench load of you, one of you at a time with the sergeant to do it, nobody else went in, and just 2 of you. And then you went from, after you threw your grenade, he told you no, you went out and he'd take another one. But there was one chap dropped one in there, got a bit nervous, I suppose, in the sergeant, and he dragged this bloke out quick before he went off. And, just already banging, he cursed and swore at him a bit for dropping it. He said, so I told you to chuck it, not drop it. But those things happened, didn't they, really? People got a bit nervous at the whole thing, because if you're not used to it, before that, when I was, we joined the local defence volunteers in the first place, down the lane. That was the first LDV, wasn't it? And then the Home Guard came in after that, didn't it?
Where were you a member of the LDV?
In the lane itself. And the bloke that was in charge of us, he was an Italian, Carpellis his name was, Major Carpellis. And he had a hut, the army put a hut at the back of his house, and we just got there and do a bit of training and that. And then when it went from there to the Home Guard, we used to go down to what they call Milan Rifle Range. And they'd made different blokes up to a sergeant and all this, and we used to have to do a bit of drill with these 303 rifles, what we had. We nearly all had rifles in the end. And I believe my brother, he had an automatic Browning. And we used to go on guard of the night times up at what they call Whisperer's Aerodrome, where the Canadians were, the Canadians in the big ace, at Whisperer's Ace. and we used to have to go up on this aerodrome, but it was only a civilian aerodrome, wasn't being used at the time. But we used to have to, about six of us used to go up there at night time, and with a corporal or something in charge of us, and we used to do so many hours on, so many hours off to the morning, and we used to push back our way back home to where we lived. But after that, after I left, after I got caught up, my brother, they used to go down to Bognor on the beach. Bognor Beach night times from, I suppose, when Dido was getting there, because he never been in the army, because he was on the agriculture side, you see. And they used to go down to Bognor night times for all night shift, like, you know, and then come back and do their work during the day on the farms.
So coming back to Chester, you were doing the MT training.
That's right, yeah.
Then what?
Well, after I'd done the MT training, I got posted then to Dumfries, a place called the Barony, where the 2nd Battalion Middlesex were. And they was understaffed then, like, you know, well understaffed. When I went in, there was only just one vehicle there. It was a wireless vehicle. And they gave me, because I was on the, I'd done this MT, and then they gave me a, give me this wireless vehicle to look after while I was there. But we weren't there many weeks before we was reinforced with, from the King's Royal Rifle Corps. We had quite a intake from there. And then we went to, we come down to Luton on the train and picked up all new vehicles, Bedford vehicles, and in armoured carriers we picked up as well, for, you know, for the old battalion. And then we, as we got fully reinforced with all our equipment, we moved from Dumfries over the Barony up to Thorn Hill.
What was the Barony? A house?
A big house, yeah, big estate. It was a big house, it was, yeah. And evidently troops had been there before us, because there was assault courses and all there, like, you know, and there's all these huts. And we used to go at, from there, we used to go out on a lot of firing with the artillery and all that into the hills around Dumfries. And after that, we moved on to this place called Thorn Hill. There was a little tiny village. And we was a company on our own there. A company was on our own. The battalion was about 3 miles down the road with the other companies in. But A company, we were always on our own, because we was known as the assault company to go in with the 8th Brigade, that's right. We had to go in, which was attached to 8th Brigade for all their dues, like, you know. And even then we moved right from there, we moved right up to near Inverness, Elgin, and we got our landing craft there. And then we went from there to do our landing craft training. We used to go down to Fort George and used to get on these LCTs, landing craft tanks, and the infantry battalions was with us as well. And they used to go out on these LCOs and come back in. And we'd done that, well, we was in the best part of what, I suppose, 1842, 44, yeah. So I joined in 42, and we came all the way back from Scotland down to Rowland's Castle on March 44.
And were you a truck driver, a lorry driver?
I was a carrier driver, armoured carrier driver, with a machine gun on the... We weren't fitted on top, we were fitted on top for D-Day. You stood up on the tripod on there for D-Day. But otherwise, we used to... They used to be stacked on. There used to be three other blokes there. You know, in the corporal and the carrier with you, what was in charge of what name, and you used to just jump off the carrier with the tripod and the machine gun and the ammunition and the water can, because there used to be a condenser can on them, because they're water cooled, like, you know, the steam, weren't they?
This is the Vickers, isn't it?
Yeah, Vickers, yes. And we used to just take, you know, drive down to close to a wood and just drop the machine guns off. And then we used to reverse the carriers back up so far while they were firing. Then once they finished firing, we used to slip back down there and pick them up again.
But you knew how to fire the Vickers machine gun?
Oh yes, you had to learn everything about the machine gun, with the stoppages and everything like that. and change the barrels and all this, you know.
What were the stoppages?
Well, mainly was the extractors. When the extractor come back, it used to pull the end of the cap off the shell of the, when you were good forward, you just left the shell, and you used to pull the end of the shell off and leave the rest of the shell up in there. So you had like a, what do you say, I suppose what they call like an easy hit today. It was a straight bit of wet line, but you pushed it in, but when you pulled back, it come straight like an umbrella, and you pulled it back and it pulled the shell back out. But that's one of the main problems. The end of the cap used to come off, leave the shell, rest of the shell up in there.
Did it happen often?
Not all that often, no. We found that, from D-Day onwards, we had some terrific shoots, you know, ammunition shoots. I've got a book here somewhere of, many rains we've fired through the record rains that really went through the machine guns, and hardly any stoppages at all.
Was that the only type of stoppage?
Well, you just get the spring break in the lock, in the firing lock. You have to replace the spring in the lock sometimes. But it was very rare, like, you know. We seemed to have a good, you know, good weapon they were, really, I think, for stoppages, you know, less stoppages. Well, just like the brain gun, you never had many stoppages on the brain gun, really. Mainly you just have to change the barrel. Because you never know, we never found we had any casings locked up in the barrel, like, you know, on the Vickers, like, what we had.
But you used to have to change the barrel on the Vickers as well?
Yeah, you used to have to change the barrel on the Vickers, yes.
Why was that?
Well, they used to get overheated and all that, you know, after a continual fire, and they used to, always carry spare barrels. And even at D-Day, we had some dud barrels D-Day for the Vickers. And, of course, lucky we carried a load of spare barrels for D-Day, so we was, because when we went D-Day, we all put new barrels in. I never, but I mean, the blokes had done the machine gun, not, you know, the 1, 2, and 3.
So you had to take a hot barrel off?
Oh, yeah, take a hot barrel off, yeah, pull it out.
How did you protect your hand then?
Eh?
How did you protect your hand from the heat?
Well, they had these gloves, like asbestos glove things to pull them out. But the brain gun, you had a handle on the brain gun, so you just pulled that rein, took it out of socket and pushed it forward. So you never had to hold the hot barrel on those, but the Vickers had hot barrel. You have to take the cone off the front, flash eliminating cone off the front, and pull the barrel out.
And does the new barrel screw in?
No, just push it straight into the back of the, wouldn't it? You had to take the flash eliminating off the front, then you can push the barrel in from the back, a new barrel in from the back, and pull the other one out, you see?
So you could do it quickly?
You could fairly quickly, yeah.
Were the carriers easy to drive?
Oh, yeah, very easy, yeah. They had a stick. Well, the first ones had joysticks, well, they were joysticks. But then they reverted into the steering wheel. And when they returned the steering wheel, whatever way you turned it, it locked the track either side, like, and you turned either way, you know, left or right. They were very reliable. They were a very reliable thing. They were, we never had no breakdowns in engine-wise or anything like that.
So you said you went down to Roland's Castle?
Yeah, I went in the camp at Roland's. Well, I come from Scotland. I come down by sea with the landing craft with the carriers in. Then we unloaded at Gosport and brought them back to Roland's Castle. The rest of the battalions, they come down by lorries and all that, and trains, down to what they. Because all the vehicles, there's an actual div convoy from Scotland, you know, all the forward vehicle drivers, the forward drive vehicles. And they, on the way down, they drove all the, it was just one divisional convoy, and they pulled in different petrol stations, filled up with petrol, and away they went at the other end and carried on. Right, they got to, they stopped overnight at a couple of American places on the way down. I couldn't tell you what place where they told me all this. And, you know, had a meal, and then away next morning, and they arrived in Roland's Castle, and they come down, we brought our carriers back to Roland's Castle, parked them outside of Roland's Castle, and we all went in the camp, everybody went in the camp, except the Provost Sergeant of that. And I was in the camp 3 days in Roland's Castle there, and I was told to go out, because while I was up in Inverness in it, I went on a week's waterproofing course over the Isle of Bute for this waterproofing course when I was in. They showed you how to waterproof the vehicles, like, you know, put all this, like, plasticine stuff, oil, you know, grease with plasticine mixed with it. And, you know, you put all that over the plug holes and all the leads, you've done that with all this plasticine, and tape, and you put, if the vehicle's had an exhaust, you had to put an extension on the exhaust and take it up the side of the vehicle so the water didn't go back in the exhaust. In the air intake, you had the R of the air intakes as well on the vehicles. But on the carriers, we never had to because we had side screens welded to the side, another 18 inches of side screen all the way around the carrier. So when we landed D-Day, like, you know, you could land in a depth of water so it wouldn't come over top the carrier. And well, everything went off all right. Like, I went in waterproof from down there for after 3 days. They turned me at the camp, and I'd go with the pro show and throw a corporal up to the where the vehicles was, these carriers and that. And I just waterproofed all the vehicles there, and the other chaps, they used to come out every so often to look at the machine guns and all this, what was on the carriers, you know, clean them and all that, and clean their carriers up, the drivers and that. And I stayed out. I never went back in Ron's car, so no more. Not in the camp until they come out. Whenever they come out to the carriers, we used to have to Kubota and that. We used to go down across the fields, so we never integrated with what they're being told in the camp and what we knew outside what was going on, because we didn't really know what was going on at all. Then we come out of the camp and moved we went down to Newport, and we got on these landing craft, and we done a dummy run on the landing craft and landed back at near Littlehampton on the beach. Then we made our way back to Rowan's Castle there, and then we went from there then into Purbrook, parked down the street at Purbrook, and stayed there about a week, I think we say, something like a week, anyway. And then we moved from there to the woods at Fareham, and then we made our way from Fareham down to the Gosport, down on the Hard, where we was loaded on our landing craft on June the 3rd. And then we went out, after we got loaded, we went out to sea, and we stayed out hovering about the sea for until the June the 6th come up. We knew there was a cancellation on the 5th, but we never come back in. Some come back in, but not the air chaps, the infantry. They reckon they come back ashore and then we get loaded back on again, but we don't know. That's only what they talked about. But we stayed at the sea and just hovered around the sea until the whole invasion was going to take place, and we just seemed to get into a convoy and away we went. And we didn't know really where we was going to land until we was about 3 or 4 miles off the beach, I suppose, and the officer come and said, like, you know, you're going to land at this place, it's going to be called Normandy, he said. And he said, you got your French money and you got your book. We all had our French money in the book, you see.
Which book?
The French book, you know, translation book from English, wouldn't they, see? Learn a bit of French for this. And from then we went in, because we was the first brigade to go in, 8th Brigade. We went in with the Suffolks, East Yorkshire and South Lancs infantry. And the commanders went in before us, headed the beach. And there were some beach marshals from our company, Sergeant Watson, Corporal Irons, and from the battalion was Major anyway. He was second in command of the battalion. And they landed on the beach before we did. And they supposed to be beach marshals and tell us where we had to go once we hit the beach. They was there directing us which way to go. And we found them. We never found them, first off, because they lost their radio. Because when they come to come in, the RCT got hit the show, and decided to go back out and come in again. But when then was, the water was too deep, so they just pushed the, because the wireless thing was on like a, what should I say, a pram thing, on a two-wheel pram thing, what they was fitted in there, and one, there was two of them, they were caught in the sergeant there, and they, but they just dumped it overboard and they swam ashore, and they just stood up on the beach and we waved us, you know, when we caught sight of them, we waved us where we had to go, but we couldn't get off the beach, because it was crazy, you know, getting crazy and crazy, because there was two tanks blown up on the exit of the beach. Well, I think the track was blown off of one, and they had to wait for an armored bulldozer to remove it. But on the landing craft that I come on, there was an armored bulldozer with us, you see, it belonged to the Royal Engineers. And the anti-tank gun belonged to the Suffolk Regiment, was on there too. You know, they had a carrier just the same as what it did with an anti-tank gun on the back. So we had to wait some, quite a considerable time before we get off the beach, because everything was held up and, you know, everything was being piled on there, and the shells were coming thick and fast, and the machine gun fire and all, you know, was pretty hectic. We really didn't know what to expect. But the only thing on what I can say about my lot, I mean, they was all in Dunkirk. They was all regular soldiers. They was in the Dunkirk evacuation, see? So, the chap in charge of the whatnot, and there was Colonel Horrocks, was in charge of the battalion at Dunkirk, and evidently what we heard, like, you know, and they just, the chaps were taught, you know, before and after, like, you know, they said that was Colonel Horrocks just said to him, well, every man for himself. So they just made their way down to the beach, and they never went actually into Dunkirk, but they made their way to the beach, and they said they got up onto an old trawler thing what was laying low in the water there, and the ship came along, picked them up, and away they went. And that's how they got off at Dunkirk.
That was the second Middlesex?
Second Middlesex, yes.
When you landed on Sword Beach, were you conscious of enemy fire?
No, well, I didn't know what to expect, really, not when we landed. I didn't know. But there was, after we, well, when we was coming in to land, there was shells hitting some of the different landing craft and blowing them up. And then there's quite a lot of machine gun fire from the inland coming in from the pillboxes and all that. And of course we made ourselves up to the beach, and we stayed there, you know, so we said, some considerable time before we really moved off to our objective, because we couldn't get off the beach. It was just choking with vehicles and that. But once we got clear of the beach, we made our way into Hermanville slightly, and then we cast off to Colville. We had to make our way to Colville, to a fortification called Hillman. And that's before we got there, one of our chaps in the carrier, I can't hear his name now, he got caught by an 88 on the crossroads in this 88. Well, it went right through him, and evidently I never see it, but they said it went right through him, and the officer, Lieutenant Milne, he was in charge of the carrier, and they said he got hold of the, because the machine gun was mounted on top of the carrier, and he got up there and he took out this 88 with a machine gun, you know, killed the crew. And then we carried on from there, and then we went into Colville to take Hillman, of course, and of course we spread it, because there was three platoons in the company, you see. We spread out with different, with the stuff was on the line, and got into Colville, and just got out of Colville there and going to Hillman, and they got mortar pretty tidy, with these mortars from the Germans, and I didn't know then, and I've only learned since, that John Holmes, I've got the paperwork upstairs, and yeah, John Holmes is a chap, he got wounded. And the young girl and the chap was there, and the sergeant said, well, we can't stop, we've got to keep going, we've got to go. So, and she turned around and said, well, I'll look after him. And she said, I looked after him. And we learned since that he, well, I've seen the lady since anyway, and he died in her arms. and they buried him in this field at Colville, which I presume was our field, because after 48 years, well, the history book said two chaps was missing, was John Holmes and Sergeant Fairclough, you see. Well, I never knew what happened to John, nor did what happened to Sergeant Fairclough. No, well, anyhow, so we got there, and evidently he died, is what this lady told us. So I see her 50 years later, and she died in his arms, in her arms. She